Welcome to episode 29 of Never On Anything podcast. This podcast is an occasional chat with a buddy. See, I've changed the intro now. Look at that. About a comic series or a creator we are fans of. We will dissect and reflect and occasionally chuckle. That's a work in progress, that intro. My name's Tony Esmond, right on the upcoming Tony Osmond is a Movie Star, which is released next month. Today we have a returning guest, one of the members of both the That Comic Smell podcast and an indie comics reviewer for the Lakes International Comics Festival podcast. He's also an editor, co-editor with me over at Fair Spark Books. Yes, it's Tom Stewart. Hello, Tom.
Hello. God, that sounds like such a list.
It's all right, oh, isn't it?
See, when you lay it all out like that. It's not bad. Sounds nice. Thank you for that. Yeah.
And also, because I forgot to say it last Sunday, happy birthday for last Sunday. My apologies.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, buddy. Thank you. That's very kind of you. You were already kind enough to me as it was.
I'm just desperate, much richer
in comics for it.
I'm just desperate for friends, Tom. That's how it works.
You and me both.
Yeah. Right, we have got a fucking bastard of a book to go through tonight. One that I have at least. I think I might be in competition this week for the amount of post-it notes I have in a graphic novel compared to, I think Russell showed me his copy of Vigilante last week and it was full of post-it notes, which I'm sure we didn't get to half of. But this is a book that's full of points of discussion, both good and bad, I'm going to say. Did you want to tell the listeners what we're going to talk about, Tom?
We are going to talk about the fun, family-friendly...
Butt-centric.
Daniel Klaus's David Boring.
Brilliant. Excellent. An inspired choice, my friend. I'm a fan of Klaus, and we'll talk about that in a bit, I'm sure. But where did you first encounter him?
I think I kind of came into the same as a lot of people. I'd spotted the Ghost World film. A lot of people of my kind of age, anyway, had spotted the Ghost World film, but I never actually watched it until much later. I saw based on a comic book, and sort of thought, "Oh, what's that?" And then saw the comic book beside. I think at the time they were doing the comic book in the local video shop or something like that. You were getting it with the video when you were taking it out. Which sounds insane to me now when I think about it, but I got the comic book away with me because I was friends with the person at the video shop,
right?
And I remember being severely confused, didn't understand it in any way, shape, or form because I was way too young.
And, I mean, we'll talk about it, but that's kind of the point often, I think, with these books, aren't they? Do you think?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. There's only a few of his that he does. Where there's a strict coherency and an actual straight form narrative about it, but we'll get to that, as you say. But yeah, that was where I probably stumbled across Klaus. But David Boring was actually given to me by David of That Comic Smell.
Oh, the Robinson.
Very much so. Arbroath, we used to go to a reading group at Arbroath Library. He actually pointed me onto it. Yeah.
I'll tell you why later, but I'm a visitor to Arbroath regularly. I've got family there. It's pretty fucking windy up here, I've got to tell you. Yeah.
I try not to venture.
As I've got friends in, I've got family in Dundee, as I've told you, up the hill in a pub I went into where I was told not to speak. Yeah, there you go. Good oath. So for those who don't know what we're talking about, David Boring was serialised, as are a lot of Daniel Klaus's work, in the series 8-Ball, which is kind of his comic. It's not monthly, because it's never monthly, but it's a comic. It ran between issues 19 and 21, in between 1998 and 2000. It is a book that is... I don't want to say rambling, Tom, but it goes a bit all over the place. It's not focused, put it that way. I mean, a book doesn't have to be. It's a book in three acts. I think the first act is the self-titled one, as I understand it, or is it called...
Yeah, if I'm, if I remember, story in three acts is David Boring's the first one. I'm pretty sure you're right.
Yeah, I couldn't work out whether it was David Boring or Yellow Streak, which is the comic within a comic, I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute. The second act is Hulligan's Wharf, and the third act is Crime and Judy. Now, the book has a vague structure in that it starts off urban. It starts off with, I don't know how you'd put it, it's kind of a black and white, noirish, nightmarish kind of thing going on, a murder mystery, you know. What do you think? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
It's very much. It screams David Lynch to me.
Yeah, it's a much compared style, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, even so much as reading it, the way through the entirety of the black and white scale of it, the way that he's drawn people sort of walking in certain landscapes and whatnot down at, well, Hooligan's Wharf or in the town where they live or anything, there is an odd, ominous soundtrack that kind of plays along in your mind as you're reading it.
Yeah,
it is very meandering and all over the place, and there is a lot of things to it, but it's an odd one. It's oddly compelling.
Yes.
Oddly compelling. Yep.
That's a good way of putting it. So just to summarise the three sections, because they are, they can be discerned, they can be differentiated between. So the first one is, happens, there's a murder mystery, his friend turns up, he's murdered, and it ends with David Boring, the titular character, being shot. The second one is, actually happens on this sort of, almost like Cheese Dream Island, I like to call it, you know. It's not a nightmare. You can't call it a nightmare island, but there's certainly, I wouldn't want to be stuck there. It's just strange, and it's on the sort of the twilight zones if you're an acid. He ends up on this island with these individuals because they think there's this overbearing feeling of the world being destroyed, which is hinted at and mentioned in various times. And then the third one is Crime and Judy, which kind of takes it back into the city, makes it something of a, it's not a detective series, but there's elements to that. It's not a mystery, but there's elements to that. It's not an urban romance, but there's elements to that. But, and then it ends up back on the island again. And like, it's a strange one, man. I find it very difficult to keep track of it. It took me a couple of reads before I figured out who everyone was, you know?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's, I don't know. There's just something about it that just brings me to it every time. And like you say, I don't know. It's just really strange. Like you say, it does take a wee while to figure out who everybody is, because he hides a lot of the characters as well. He brings them on for a couple of panels and then takes them out of the equation again.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in silhouette in it, aren't there? You get people following people, or even the man who fires the gun, we don't discover who he is for another, you know, another chapter or so.
Yeah, and I thought about that as I was reading through it. That must have been excruciating for people that were reading 8-Ball.
because
they were only getting parts, you know what I mean?
This is not his infamous comic Bugfucker about a man who fucks bugs. This is much more a slow burn on this one. Yeah.
I like him.
Where does he sit amongst this sort of crowd of creators for you, man? Because I mean, there are people who are, I suppose, in some way comparable to Klaus, or in perhaps the same section of the, you know, the library. You've got the likes of Charles Burns, you've got Seth, Bob Fingerman, even Adrian Tamine, Joe Matt, Mary Fleener, even the Hernandez brothers to a certain extent. Sit in the similar sort of area, you know.
Yeah, they all are of the same sort of ilk, very much so. I mean, I rate him really highly, but that's just purely because I'm kind of a, I would say I'm a Klaus fanboy.
Yeah.
I mean, anything that kind of crops up of his, I'll jump on. But I just like the cartoonist style that he has, the solid lines and the sort of harsh blocky shading and everything, and the highlights and everything that he's got as well. So I rate him quite high, but just that list that you kind of rattled off there, they are all fairly similar when you start to compare a lot of work.
There's an individualism to them, isn't there, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
There's a clarity of voice, I think, for each of them. and they're all people who've been sort of consistently putting out good work for many years and fallen into that. We never used to have these grooves that people fall into, but I think time has sort of created that, where we see them in different sections of the library. So let's talk a little bit about the story, and then we'll talk a little bit about Klaus, and as we pick our way through, we'll probably talk a little bit about the themes. I have my copy here. Let's talk about the cover first for the Jonathan Cape version that I've got. Normally, mm-hmm. Fantagraphics, I believe, Fantagraphics are the people who put 8-Ball out, aren't they? But this is Jonathan Cape. I don't know. I found the cover slightly misrepresentational of the book inside. It looks like I was trying to pin it down. It looks like a sort of eerie. Russian industrial propaganda art advert almost.
It's really strange. I mean, he's almost got like a sort of holy like
halo
glow coming off the back of him as well. It very much gives you that, like you said, the propaganda thing. It very much gives you that sort of Northern Korea great leader
good point
feel to it, definitely, which is just, like you said, it's bizarre because it isn't representative of anything that really happens in the interiors at all.
Yeah, it's got that. If anyone knows the sort of the eras of Russian art, I quite enjoy it. Is there's the patriotic era between 39 and 45, where he would be the David Boring character, is almost like elect me, I'm the local town official, and behind him is what it's kind of a cityscape, stroke a dock, stroke a factory, you know, sort of thing. And and you're right, he appears as the hero image in the middle of it. It's not done without humour. I think there is a certain satire there, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's just an odd one. You don't know where Klaus is really coming from with it either, to be honest. Even if as you work through the piece, you can go back to the cover and you still don't know.
Yeah.
Really where he was coming from and making that cover in any way, shape or form.
Now, it's also, I wanted to ask you this, is the book is dated, so he dates events in it. So it opens, it's now February the 24th, 1998, at 2:40 a.m. So it actually dates stuff. However, if you didn't see those dates, where would you put it? Where would you think it was from a time, stylistically?
Looking at everybody and how he styled everybody, I would have said early 60s.
I was going to say 65. So yeah, we're in the same ballpark there, man.
Yeah,
everyone's got.
Yeah, definitely. Just
gone. Sorry, man.
Just everybody's dressed. They've all got like sort of bowler hats or fedoras and lots of long coats, and they're all wearing sensible shoes. And there's like dotted. Low skirt dresses on some of the people in the bars and stuff like that. It's odd.
There's an element of the McGinnis sort of paperback novel stuff going on, but in a twisted way, as Klaus manages to be. He twists your perceptions of everything that happens. It opens on David Boring, who, as is the want with a lot of Klaus stories, having probably the most awkward sex you'll ever see.
Like two skeletons. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and this grubby him laying on top of her looking like pretty, unplussed about it, you know, not really interested in him with this sort of dull look on his face. But he is a sexual obsessive in a way, isn't he? So he's got a certain kink about him.
Yeah, he does. Even though he doesn't really, he kind of half admits to it throughout the piece as well. Throughout the whole story, he'll half admit to being a kind of sexual deviant in a way. But he doesn't like to discuss it really with anybody except from, well, what we find out when we go further in just a couple of pages. He only really likes to discuss it with his flatmate and nobody else. The reader. That's about it.
Yeah. What do you think of him as a character? How would you describe him?
Do you know what? He's completely unlikable.
Isn't he?
Honest.
Totally.
He really is. He's completely unlikable. He just moans and complains all the time. And yet, I don't know how Klaus does it. He makes you want to find out what's going to happen, even though really it's a set of unlikable characters in very mundane situations. And yet he just kind of sets the page out in a way that you're still intrigued to move forward through each of the story. I don't know if it's just because he's shying characters or situations just off panel, so you feel like you have to move with it. Because otherwise, I think if you just put all of these characters center page and let them talk, you would just be bored out of your mind otherwise.
Yeah. I don't know whether he's playing with this by calling him that, you know.
Yeah, I think so. That's the thing. If you're going to go into a comic that's title is David Boring, then you know you got to expect some sort of subversion of story or something. You know, you can't expect to go into something that is actually titled Boring and expect it to be what it turns out to be. Yeah, you know?
He is. I mean, I wouldn't, if he's the sort of bloke who'd ring, you know, say we knew him in the comic, you know, small press world, and he would say, oh, do you fancy going for a drink? You'd go, oh, Christ, really? Yeah.
yeah, definitely. He is one of them that sort of says, oh, you fancy going round the shops? No. No, I don't. No. But you don't want to ask him to leave because you feel that you'd break his soul, but at the same point, you're like, God, I wish he'd just go home.
But saying that, then maybe this is what we're missing with these people, Tom, is or I'm probably one of those people, to be fair, is is there's a darkness behind him. There's an obsessive personality disorder thing going on, isn't there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. But then there seems to be an obsessive nature behind a lot of his friends and his family and everything that he meets as well. They're all either quietly or quite abruptly obsessed with something. I mean, even his friend that he meets in the later pages, he's kind of obsessed with luck and what seems to be like a yearning for the university life that he's got, and it's just odd.
Yeah. And I think, is it Dottie? Is that Dot? Is that, what's the name of his flatmate? I can't remember. I'm blanking on it suddenly. Is it Dottie?
Dot.
Yeah. Dot. She's, I mean, she's a dark character because she seems to be obsessed with sleeping with straight women who are married. Is a recurring theme in her romance, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
Which takes its revenge on a couple of occasions. So we get a slow burn start compared to some of the moments in this, I think. And we realise he has this ever present or ever sort of floating above us somewhere scrapbook with this girl's butt in it. He's got a butt scrapbook, as I've described it in my notes.
yeah, he does.
Yeah. And his friend Whitey appears, who is strange, a strange individual with a strange sort of hat, strange sense of dress, and he's carrying like a paper bag, which I think has probably got some kind of clothes in it or something. And he appears, and He turns out to be quite the hit with the ladies.
I have no idea why.
Yeah, and I don't know.
I know what you mean.
What's he telling us there? I'm not sure. Actually, sure what Klaus is saying about him. Yeah,
he's an odd character as well because he's somebody that, with his introduction and the way he comes into it in these first couple of pages, you expect him to be around, quite a lot, even just within the first few pages, but. You know, you get an introduction to him, and then they go to that bar.
Yeah.
And he is quite a hit with the ladies, goes across and speaks to a couple of different women. He gives David his coin, and then he's not really kind of seen for the next wee while.
No.
Not even kind of spoke about.
He's not.
Which is odd.
And there's another awkward sex moment. Boring has another awkward sex moment where I remember reading this in... must have been the 90s, I suppose, when I read it, and thinking, wonder what she's doing with his towel. I don't know, why is she doing it? Just have a shower. Do you know what I mean? She's sort of swabbing his whatever off her leg.
Yeah, I can't. Do you know what? It's really odd.
Yeah.
I thought about that as well. Like, if she's in the bathroom, why not just go for a shower? But
yeah.
Yeah, I think it's maybe just trying to... Klaus almost sometimes tries to take away the glamour behind sex that's really depicted in films and everything. He really puts it as flat and as uneventful as possible to try and show you that, you know, if there's going to be sex in something, it doesn't have to be this sort of ramshackled, exciting thing that's depicted in movies. It can just be this, right?
Yeah.
I'm done, and now I'm cleaning the semen off my leg.
Yeah.
You know,
there's no soundtrack to this one, is there? There's no soft rock soundtrack in the background or,
no.
You know,
God, no.
Curtains blowing or anything like that. Yeah. I think almost as well he's setting up this obsession for him. I think we're setting up the... He's obsessed with perfection, isn't he, Boring? Although he's so insipid.
Yes.
He has this sort of... this perception of what his perfect woman is to him, and he needs to possess them rather than know them, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange because the in that situation, in those first few pages as well, as he's speaking to Dot and then he takes that girl home, you could almost mistake the girl beside him as Dot.
Yeah, you really could, couldn't you? Yeah.
Yeah.
That confused me for a minute when I was reading it.
That kind of confuses me throughout, because I think a lot of the women that he gets with kind of look like Dot,
yeah,
but with different hair.
Even the older woman, Hulligan's Warfare, is, she looks a bit like her, you know.
Yeah, she does. It really does throw you off. And yet he is quite good at doing distinctive faces. He does quite feminine features well, I think.
Yeah.
I think he does people really well and discerns them quite well. You're able to tell them apart, but I don't know why. I don't know if he deliberately did that, that everybody that David gets with kind of looks like Dot, meaning that everybody that he floats towards has that same ideal face and figure and everything that he's going for, right down to his friends. You know?
It's a weird one, because he and Dot have a brother and sister relationship, don't they? When he's upset, she lays next to him in bed and kisses him on the cheek and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And she threatens whoever breaks his heart, but also tells him to stop getting with women. And you're right, it's a very incestuous brother and sister relationship, but yeah, it is.
I was thinking about this in comparison to like A Velvet Glove, Cast in Iron, which is his book from 93, which mm-hmm. stylistically is kind of slightly more grotesque. I think, have you read that one?
Yes, I have. That one's, yeah, you're right, it's slightly more on the Charles Burns scale, I would say,
yeah.
In that it is very much trying to freak you out from each page and make you very uncomfortable. Not that this doesn't, not that David Boring doesn't make you feel uncomfortable, but yeah, like A Velvet Glove, very much.
Yeah.
It does, that you're right, it is more grotesque in a way.
Yeah, that's more of a trip, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but it is another one that's like a murder mystery again.
Yeah.
In a way. I was having this conversation that a lot of Klaus stories, in a sense, have that underlining narrative of a murder mystery.
Okay.
Not necessarily there has to be an actual murder have happened, but you do have that trying to track somebody down throughout most of his books. I mean, he's got it even in Patience.
Yeah, that's true.
There's that whole thing of trying to... It's that guy trying to track down who killed his partner and trying to stop it from happening. It's something that seems to happen throughout. I wonder if it's a theme that runs with Klaus personally.
Yeah.
He's always trying to solve a mystery, maybe even just this is going to sound artsy-fartsy, but maybe even the mystery of life, as they say.
Yeah, so it's
he's just kind of telling that within the pages.
So I actually found Patience really different, I have to say.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit about Klaus now, shall we? So I think it's about time. So Daniel Klaus, born 1961 in Chicago, grew up reading his older brother's comics, old DC comics from the 50s, old horror comics. Quite a comics fan at the time. It's always nice to know. And he remembers using a copy of Fantastic Four 1 to hold over his head and run to the car to meet his grandmother to keep the rain off his head. And he still has that copy of Fantastic Four, which I kind of thought, oh, that's good. I like that.
Oh, wow.
Some of his standout books are Like a Velvet Glove, Cast 9, which just mentioned in 93, Ghost World 97, David Bore in 2000. He does illustrations for The New Yorker, Newsweek, Vogue, Village Voice. As we said, Ghost World, Art School Confidential and Wilson have all been adapted into movies. I don't think Wilson was by Terry Zwigoff. I haven't looked that one up. It's the one I haven't seen. I've not heard great things about it.
So.
But I do like the comic.
It's not amazing.
Yeah, have you seen it, have you?
Yeah, I made it some of the way through and fell asleep, unfortunately. it's not great,
okay.
Which is a shame because it's, yeah.
Whilst While studying at the Pratt Institute, he started a small press publisher called Look Mum Comics. His first work was in 1985 in Cracked, and he worked under pen names, and one of them was Stosh Gillespie, and he did a strip called The Ugg Family. He started Lloyd Llewellyn, which I think is where I first saw his stuff, in 1985, and that appeared in Love and Rockets right. 13, believe it or not, so it's quite a thing. Before heading into his own magazine that was put out by Fantagraphics, which was kind of mostly his home. 8 Ball began in 85, ended in 2004. Then we got stuff like Ice Haven, Mr. Wonderful, The Death Ray, some of which had taken out of 8 Ball. In 2006, he had quite a serious heart condition and went in for open heart surgery. And after that, we got Patience, which is interesting, an interesting stylistic change after a sort of life-changing incident. I've in preparation for tonight, I've listened to quite a few interviews and watched him being interviewed quite a few times. And there's some interesting ones on there. And he says in one of them that he hasn't read a superhero comic since Kurt's one gave up on Superman, which is interesting. Right. It's sort of reflective in his work. He's most famously been ripped off by Shia LaBeouf, which I'm sure you know about. Shia LaBeouf did a short movie called HowardCanton.com, and it was copied from a story Klaus did for a charity anthology called The Book of Other People, in a book, a story he did called Justin M. Domeno, which I haven't read, actually. I haven't read that one, but I've seen the little sort of short documentary.
No, I didn't know that story either.
Oh, okay.
Actually.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Shia LaBeouf's quite a comics fan. He had a table one year in New York with a sort of weird comic he'd made. Yeah. I mean, we could develop a podcast with weird Shia LaBeouf stories, couldn't we? I know, but he did. He designed the labels Klaus for OK Soda, which was a short-lived soft drink company, and he did the artwork for them, which I would like to get one of those, you know, just to see that. Sort of
I'm with you on that.
He's still a lot of Sub Pop album covers. I've got one, which is an album, one of the Billy Childish groups called the Headcoats. In an album called Heavens to Murgatroyd, which just completely coincidentally I bought because I'm a bit of a Billy Childish fan. But I heard him say on a podcast this very morning that he's never listened to any of the albums for the art he has which done, which is kind of weird. I've met Klaus a couple of times. I met him. I had breakfast with him. I managed to sort of blag my way in as a complete interloper at a convention in LA, which had virtually zero fans at. And because I'm pals with Bob Fingerman and Joe Data, we sat there having breakfast, and we were joined by Mary Fleener and Daniel Klaus. So I got to have a conversation with him, and he was exactly as I expected him to be, friendly but slightly distant. he's got that. There's an element of strangeness to him, which I'm glad there is, you know, which is translated into his books in many ways, you know.
Yeah, you know what? It's almost a bit disheartening if you meet somebody that makes artwork like this and they're just like happy go lucky.
Yeah, no,
and you're sitting like, oh shit, that makes no sense. Oh. It's almost devastating in a way. So I am actually quite glad to hear that. He in recent years especially seems to always take photographs just looking like the grumpiest person in the world.
He does, doesn't he? I got Vince and Dan a copy of Pussy? I never say it, but
Pussy.
I got them a copy of them, made out to them, and I said, I've got to take a picture just to show that you actually signed it. And he just made that face. he'd been totally fine at that point. We've been chatting and he'd been laughing and stuff, and then he just made that face. Interesting, he read comics, or he looked at comics before he could read. So he says part of what he does is reflective of that sort of formation period of his artwork, because he would interpret things into the creatures in comics because he couldn't read what they were saying or what the story was. And he said in that he found them quite frightening. Which I suppose, if you don't know what the thing from the Fantastic Four is saying, he is a frightening looking guy. And I think that's an interesting idea that's translated. You can see a bit of that, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. You really can. It's funny. You're saying all these little pieces about him, and I'm sitting going, yeah, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It really does.
I'm glad, the last time I ever made any sense. Yeah. he is a guy, and we're talking about where does he sit. He is a guy that I will always buy the book of whenever I see it.
Yeah.
I've been really taken by more work than I haven't been taken with, I think, by him. And I do appreciate that he's out there slowly doing it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm very much in that, because a lot of people say that they're disappointed that he stopped doing 8-ball.
Yeah.
But I'm very much of the thought that I would rather he wasn't doing 8-ball and he was putting all his concerted effort into one big piece, like kind of like what he did with Patience.
Yeah.
And we got something like that, a bit bigger, a bit more substantial rather than little bits. As much as it would be good to have a semi-regular-ish piece coming out every now and then, I would much rather have a big chunky thing on my shelf that he's worked on.
Yeah.
Than little individual pieces, and, definitely.
And he's probably financially, that's by far the best, because I can imagine the collections of David Boring, I'm sure they outsell the 8-ball, you know. I mean, I can't imagine 8-ball sold loads. You know. Okay, so we'll carry on a little bit with the story, and we can pick some bits out, and please mention anything that you want to pick out here, dude. But well, it turns out Whitey gets murdered. So after suddenly appearing in his hat, doing a bit of shagging, Whitey gets murdered, and kind of one of the tipping points of the book is when he goes to his funeral. He has to sort of fly down to his funeral, and he shares a car with this girl. Is it Wanda, the girl he shares a car with, isn't it? And her sister.
I think it's Wanda, if I remember right.
He shares one of those.
It's really hard to stay on top of the names, because there's so many characters within this book.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah. So he gets one of those little minibuses to the airport with Wanda, and he becomes slightly fixated with her in the cab. And you see the obsessive compulsive element of David Boring suddenly come to the front there. We think, right, okay, I'm beginning to get a point. I'm beginning to understand that this guy is just like fucking... He just fixates on women.
Even renders her completely differently from any other bit in the book. Right. Just when he first sees her, so he's got the silhouette of her coming out of the apartment, him looking, and then that rendering of her is more realistic. It looks like more. Do you know what? It looks more like a haunting image out of Burns's Black Hole than it does anything else.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the rest of it, you know, he's back to, he's lost all the shade lines around the head and everything. He's only really got the baseline shades. He's less focused on the realism after that, but it's almost like he's showing you like she is important,
yeah,
right in this moment,
just before she drops the sweets on the floor, is the moment you know he's fallen in love with her, because of the way she's framed and the way she's drawn. Yeah, and you've even got the flowers and the butterfly next to her, and you know, it's that movie moment where she sort of shakes her hair out and everyone realizes, all right, you know, It's the twisted version of that, isn't it? Yeah. So he goes to the funeral. He goes to his house. He hasn't spoken to his mum for a while. He surreptitiously goes to a treehouse at the back of his garden, and he picks up the Yellow Street comic, which is another, to complicate matters more, is another theme of this comic, isn't it? The Yellow Streak is a comic that his father, who we think has died, we find out has later, he definitely has died, has done this Yellow Streak annual, which doesn't really appear anywhere in comic price guides. And he has to go to an expert to discover who it is. Now, apart from some lobby card inserts into this, the Yellow Streak sections are done in colour, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Full Zipitone, colour as well. Yeah,
and apart from the Yellow Streak and Friends Annual, which we're told later there is no actual series, this was just an annual they put out, and Testa Truehand, Tangerine, which is a sort of girl with a dog with sunglasses, Crater Carter, which is a sort of, I don't know, spaceman character with a Robin mask on, and Allergy. Allergy, really? I don't know what that's about, but it's got that sci-fi aesthetic that we now know Klaus for from Death Ray and stuff, to a certain extent, isn't it?
Yeah, it does actually. Yeah, you're right. I don't know if this was maybe like his testing ground before he got into something like
could be,
that.
Could well be.
Trying to just kind of balance the two and see how they would bounce off of each other, and then if you could mix them together.
Yeah.
It certainly seems that way anyway. That this is more like his testing ground, because even the actual renderings of it, like the Zipitone's just slightly off and everything as well. And I know he's trying to capture that aesthetic of an older comic. that's just roughly been done by some sort of amateur artist, as we kind of find out in a way. But it does. It very much looks like he's just testing that before he gets into, like, say, the death ray and whatnot.
Yeah. And then upon return from the funeral, he decides to start stalking this girl. He has to remind her twice, Wanda. He has to remind her twice who he is, which is awkward again. Everything's cringe. I mean, it predates The Office, doesn't it? Everything's cringe in this, isn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's just so unsettling, man.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's just so unsettling. And you keep, almost, if you were to take a lot of these panels and stuff out of context, you would almost think that this man is going to murder this girl.
Yeah.
If you didn't continue on the story, if you just took a panel of him sitting across from her, looking at her and sort of introducing himself again, you'd think, God, this guy's going to kill this woman. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And she's not nice. She's pretty unpleasant to him at the best of times.
Yeah.
He keeps pushing it. He keeps pushing it. And he wants to be her boyfriend, but in a way that he kind of wants to possess her, but it's not a one-sided villainy. She's just downright fucking rude to him all the time.
Yeah, she is. And even sort of later on, she just starts calling him a right creep and stuff like that, which is just... it's just odd. He doesn't have a lot of positive people in his life at all.
He doesn't, does he?
Really? Even Dot, who's like, we're saying, oh, it's like a brother sister relationship, but right down to the point that she insults him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He doesn't have a lot of positive figures within his life in the slightest.
Yeah. And she plays with him. Wanda does play with him emotionally. You know, at points she tells him he's cute. She holds his hand in the museum. I really like that sculpture museum they go to as well on page 22. Love that, man. This sort of, they go to this abstract sculpture exhibit or museum or something, and it's the nonsense of the abstract around them kind of plays the satire of the shape of her butt in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah, you're right.
Is it just me, but is there an erotic element to some of those statues? Yeah.
There's definitely a phallus or two at the end.
Yeah.
There's some weird holes, and then one's sort of placed in a way that they're pointing inward of them. It's really strange.
Yeah.
Especially the first one, the sort of curved C/O one. It's a dick going in a hole, let's be honest.
Very true, man.
You know?
Very true. Yeah, I didn't spot that till you pointed it out, but yeah, no, I totally get you there. I pretended to say. But he tries to touch her bottom. They've been on a few dates by this time, and he tries to touch her bottom, and she says, please don't ever touch my butt. It's the bane of my existence. I hate it. Why? And she says, oh, come on, it's enormous, as if you haven't noticed. Which is typical Klaus, sort of so vehemently reacted to that he has to touch it then. You know, and there's whole pages that concentrate on her butt. You know.
I think it's, what, one page over? Oh, no, sorry. It's a couple of pages over.
We get a
right cool show.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I've ever wanted a page of Klaus, which I'd obviously do, but it would undoubtedly be the butt page.
Yes.
And it's not... There's no crumb-esque element to this. It's not... I don't know. It just... Again, it's just awkward and evidence of his obsession and... He does stuff like, oh, look, I've put my hand through the pants, and now, you know, it's like...
Yeah, I think because he doesn't glorify it in a way. He puts it on full show, but he's not showing you that it's glamorous in any way, shape or form. He's not showing any appealing element to it. It's all that awkward, and this sort of sparkle of it has been completely stripped away. Yeah. Any sort of sparkle to sexual activity at all. I mean, he starts sweating profusely and everything whenever he's near that section of her. That I think it very much takes away the sort of gratuitous nature of it.
It does, totally.
In any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Moving
on slightly, because I know we're doing our usual. We're only a third way through, but the it's. I thought, and I blame you for this because you're the last person I heard say it. I had heard it before, but you said it is. I suddenly got mumblecore in my head, and I suddenly became slightly frustrated reading this book, thinking nothing's fucking happening. You know, kind of the point. And then I'm suddenly like, oh. And the reason I said oh is the last page, the end of Act 1, when the guy shoots the bullet at him. And it's so well done. Is he actually pauses the end of chapter one, the end of the first act, is paused with the smoke of the bullet and the bullet like heading towards him from a shadowy figure. It's very cleverly done.
You very much become David Boring at that last panel, because that is heading, if you're reading it, it's heading straight for you. You know, so you get to see what he saw precisely. And yeah, you're right. There isn't a lot happens before that at all. It's nothing really even worth mentioning. There's a couple of dream sequences that he has that kind of threw me off
sort of
a wee bit, because I didn't really know what was happening though, because he hasn't made them sort of discernible from the rest of the comic. He hasn't made it like wavy or anything, and he's probably done that just to kind of mess with you in a way.
Yeah.
As he has done with the story in general, so it's nothing unusual.
Yeah.
You know, he loses her. She sort of leaves him, but that's about it. You know, there's nothing else really.
Right. Yeah.
He kind of some guy notices he's reading the book, but you never really see that guy again.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's shot. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah. And that kind of leaves you. It's I kind of like the way it leaves you though. I kind of think all that effort in I put, and he's, and what's happened? You know, and reading it at the time, I remember reading it at the time and thinking, where's 8-Ball? Who knows when the next one's out? You know, who knows? Yeah. So then we move on to Hulligan's Wharf. Hulligan's Wharf is the Twilight Zone element of this book to me, where they're all stuck on this weird little island. He has been shot in the head, but for some reason it hasn't gone through his skull and out the other side. It's kind of left a big bullet hole in a like a sort of third eye kind of element to it, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. And he's wearing like a weird sort of man in the iron mask bandages to keep it from, I don't know, like his brain from falling out or something.
Yeah,
I
can't figure it out, but yeah, it's certainly affecting.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah.
It's certainly strange.
Yeah, I can't quite figure it. If it hasn't penetrated his skull in any way, then I don't understand why he's got so much bandages on. But,
yeah.
Hey-ho.
Yeah, and it takes pages and pages for it to get removed. So he ends up on this island. There's an uncle, I think, arrives on the island, and there's a rumour that there's been a gas attack in America, like a poisonous gas attack in America. So they've got to stay on this island because it's safe. There's a variety of people on the island, which is would have been a much larger island, but a house was left when the rest of it sunk. And there's a sort of housekeeper guy who stays there. Boring ends up sleeping with a woman who is older than him, a Mrs. Capon, who is his mother's cousin. Again, awkward, you know, again, strange.
Yeah.
And then she disappears. Dot starts sleeping with Iris on the island, and who's married to Manfred. And, of course, it's such a small island, he finds out. It all becomes a bit Lord of the Flies. And it ends up with, is it Manfred? I can't remember who ends up. Boring makes his way back to the island on a raft at the end of it. It's fucking weird.
It's just strange. I mean, in amongst all of that as well, he has this odd story that he tells about going away there when he was younger with his cousin and having this weird sexual first love relationship with her under the water, where they would go under and kiss each other and then come back up and everything as well. And you have Dot and oh God, what's her name again, did you say?
Mrs. Capon.
Dot and...
Oh,
Dottie.
Iris. Yeah.
Iris, yeah, sorry. You've got Dottie and Iris kind of play fighting, and it's very strange. I mean, these pages are the weirdest throughout the book.
Yeah, I think you're right, then, yeah.
I know the first has been a wee bit incoherent, and like you say, it's a bit kind of, there's nothing really happening. There's a lot happening within these pages, but it doesn't really seem like there is.
Yeah.
And yet, like I was saying to you before, I don't know if it's the way it's staged or what, but it's compelling to just keep going and find out what's happening.
Is.
I mean, even that bit when she's kind of stripping off, there's nothing really about the panels that show that you would want to see what happens with them. It's just a case of, all right, okay, she's stripping now. Right, let's go on to the next thing. I don't understand how he manages it. I don't understand how he manages to keep reading something where nothing really is going on.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
as with a lot of his work, there's a Freudian, subconscious, Oedipal element to a lot of it. Who is he actually sleeping with now? You know, this yes. woman is old enough to be his mother. She exposes her breasts to him. She is not sexy at all. She's, no, that's the wrong thing to say. She's not the sort of woman he would go for. She's not portrayed as sexy. She's just this sort of older woman sitting there drinking wine in a dressing gown. And he's got this, as I said, insipid. He's got this sort of pathetic face on him. Just annoyed me with his, like, you know.
Yeah. With the bandages on his head, looking at her.
Pathetic.
It's just, yeah. Yeah, completely.
And then he has sex with her, which is a favourite moment of his, is having sex with a favourite position, I suppose, is having sex with her from behind. And it even gives eek, screek, screek, screek. He gives that as a, yeah. Like, oh my God. Do you know what I mean? Just give up sex, mate, if that's how it is. You're clearly not enjoying, nobody's enjoying that experience at all, you know. Yeah. As I said before, sex for me, lights out, under the covers, on my own. That's it. You just switch back to that, David. Do you know what I mean? It's yeah. But it is the moment. It is the one that I think. The one, if I ever had a nightmare from the back of this book, it would be being stuck on the island with these strange individuals.
Yeah, it's the not knowing throughout it. It's the being told constantly that there's been an attack. There's been an attack of some sort. It keeps coming up every now and then. One of them will mention they want to go, and it's no. There's been a gas attack. We need to stay on this island. It's almost like that guy's trying his best just to keep them there and make them all go mad for no reason.
Some kind of sort of weird social science kind of experiment, like Big Brother for the nightmare horror crowd, you know, My Little Eye or something, like one of these sort of films where they're all stuck on the island and the food's running out and they're all at each other's throats and they've got nowhere to go and they've just got a bit of land around the island and who's going to kill themselves first? It's just...
But the only concept of time throughout all of it, though, is where David's bandages start coming off one by one. Apart from that, there's nothing. I mean, none of their hair grows or anything. Yeah. There's no cupboard showing the lack of food or anything like that. They're all just doing the exact same stuff in the exact same places, but it's just that his bandages start to come off one by one and unravel a wee bit, and he starts to get a bit better. That's the only reason you know that there's been a substantial amount of time, because a man has been shot in the head and now he has to recover from it.
Yeah.
It's surreal. And like I say, there's dream sequences throughout this as well where you're not sure that it is actually the dream. And it's just odd.
And there is an element of me that says his mother looks like his ideal woman.
Yes, 100%. She looks like Wanda, but grown up.
Yeah.
And with a double bun instead of a single.
Yeah, that's the difference. And that's why I go with the Freudian thing in this. Boring is, you know, he's Oedipus, isn't he? He's that guy with, you know, the fascination about his mum, and he's transferring it into the women he sleeps with. It's so on the nose almost, you know. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very strange. Okay, so we eventually escape the island, and I remember thinking, thank fuck for that. we get some... two of my favourite pages. One of my favourite pages, the lobby cards, Crime and Judy. We get these two sort of lobby American 1950s... They could be from a movie like Giant or something like that, you know, Rebel Without a Cause, but sort of coloured in lobby cards, and they look really nice, I have to say.
Yeah, they really do. And it's them sort of choking on the proverbial gas that they've said landed, with everything on fire and people smashing windows and everything, which I'm assuming never really actually happened.
Doesn't seem to, does it?
They never mention it.
No, it doesn't seem to.
No.
Apart from, does it happen after the end or something?
I don't know. It's like they mention it.
Yeah.
They sort of mention it briefly, like, oh, yeah, something happened, but it was finished within a day. Oh, but they'll be back. You know, you're like, what? I don't understand.
It's maybe it's the mystery of the comic, you know, the release of the comic that came out every so often. Maybe this is what was happening, because it's presented as
possibly.
A coherent graphic novel. You know, that's what the Guardian readers like to say, but it is in fact sections from a comic that are put together in a graphic novel that occurred over a period of a couple of years. Maybe that's what we're seeing.
True.
I don't know. It's a hard one, isn't it?
It's just hard to kind of tie them that
way.
Yeah,
it is.
It's funny because the three acts don't really tie except from David himself and maybe Wanda to a certain degree. That's about it.
Yeah.
None of the rest really tie in.
Yeah,
a way.
We're following. I mean, Wanda's is irregular at best, isn't she? She's there must be whole issues of April she's not in, and we're stuck with this fucking idiot. one of my other favourite pages was the first page of Crime and Judy, where they're at sea, and I would love to see more by Clowns like this. This sort of they're on this raft trying to make it through the stormy sea, and they end up back on a beach, and it's just a beautiful page with a big black broad panel in the middle to show that they've passed out and are unconscious. Really glorious.
Yeah, it's funny. That was the first kind of pages that I thought, God, I'd love to see him do an action adventure, like wordless comic.
Yes.
You know, like that Redford film, All Was Lost.
Yeah.
It'd be great to see him do something like that, but I don't think it's ever going to be in the cards for him. That's the thing.
The storyboarder of which was on the Never On Anything podcast a few episodes ago. So,
he was, yes.
The other thing is, I was reading quite a lot about him, and Klaus believes in something called the integrity of the page, which I thought might be worth talking about now. And he believes that the page is a unit of comics, and he considers his comic a page at a time. I suppose you have to, but he kind of very distinctly says that. Everything on the page has to be him, which is why he spends, if you watch any interview, he goes on about trying to find the right brush. You know, he spent years trying to find the right brush. He at the time of the interview, certainly wasn't doing anything digitally. And he says, it all has to be me. Even the lettering has to be personal. Comics, a solitary visual medium, is a documentary. He's from a quote of his. Interesting. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I can get that. Basically, just from his work, it is heavy going, and it's very much all him. I was trying to think of if I've ever seen him collaborate with anyone, and if there's been anything where somebody's maybe contributed a page or something, but there's nothing that's come to mind.
I can't think of anything. Yeah, I haven't looked into it, so I can't think of anything at the moment. I suppose the nearest thing would be Terry Zwigoff, wasn't he? He wrote those two movies for him.
It's the only kind of thing I can think of. There's even down to the cover for the Fantagraphics, We Told You So Comics is Art. He does the cover for that as well. But it is all him.
Yeah.
There's, you know, you could have had a wee bit from each person from the Fantagraphics, but he has done the whole thing. Very much so. I don't know. It shows a selfishness, but then again, it shows that you're getting an authentic Klaus at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a place for it, man. Yeah, I think so. I mean,
yeah, you're not getting any interference.
If I could draw, I'd be drawing and writing all my own comics. Yeah, I think as much as I enjoy collaborating, it just seems easier, and it seems like more of a singular voice, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a sort of magic that comes out of collaboration, but there's also magic that comes out of that single thing on the page that you've intended, and there it is. Okay.
Does that mean that he gets edited then?
I suppose he must be. Does he? Do you need to? I suppose.
I don't know if he does. I mean, I've heard interviews with Gary Groth where he sort of said, "Oh, I just leave them to it. I don't really edit. I just overlook and make sure that there's nothing."
Right.
Too out
I can
there.
Imagine.
But that's about it.
That Gary Groth kayfabe interview. Have you heard that yet? Great.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
It is. You know, it is good. I got angry with a couple of bits, but I still bow before him, to be fair. But there was a couple of bits that did infuriate me. And I thought, how could you say that? But then he's Gary Groth.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's covered everything, you know, so he gets the final
word.
He's
painfully honest sometimes. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, no, obviously I can't think of Ed Piskor without thinking of the impression that you sent me on video recently of him.
Yeah, I try to crack that out at any point.
Okay, so we're now into the third act. The third act takes, again, something of a change. It becomes something more of a crime mystery. He meets a guy. He finds out who's the one who shot him, and it's a bloke called Professor Karkis. And they begin a strange relationship because it turns out that Karkis shot him because he was jealous because Karkis was going out with Wanda before him. It's a strange, obsessive, compulsive desperation, you know, holding each other almost through their desperation to find her, and instead they find her sister. Turns out that Wanda does have a sister, yeah. And she's probably the better, nicer sister, almost.
Yeah, it's basically shown in a way that that's who David was looking for the entire time, yeah. Really, and not Wanda, which, I don't know, I think he's just settling. It's this whole thing. He's come so far, he's got to this point now where he's just thinking, yeah, she'll do, you know what I mean? Which he has done, basically, the whole way through. He's just went, yeah, she's it. Yeah, she's it.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, she's
he's with,
it, you know.
He's with a different woman to start with, so we kind of take a time jump, don't we? I mean, he's with this different woman who's he's definitely settled there, and he's just desperate to be loved and to have sex and to find a woman. And there's probably the most awkward piece of sex in this book is when there's an oral moment between him and her, and it's drawn. She looks like she's sweating, but it almost looks like she's crying. And she says to him, "This isn't working." In fact, I'm looking at this again, thinking she is crying. I'm saying crying. Page,
I think it is.
85, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to cry. Yeah.
It's a strange one.
Yeah, it has to be. Yeah, it has to be. Although she looks like Dot, but with glasses.
She does again, doesn't she? Yeah.
Yeah, she does. It's because it's another one that I got really confused at for a while. But yeah.
The mystery of the yellow streak. He begins to figure that out, and I think there's a quote that turns out his dad was killed, and that some bloke said, "Oh, he's probably killed by an overdose of pussy." You're like, okay, right. David decides he's David decides he's a vegetarian because he's afraid of the animals taking revenge. I kind of like that quote. I'm all for that.
Yeah, definitely. definitely all for that. I thought it was really strange that they decided just to say, oh yeah, his dad's dead. It was like shrouded in mystery for page upon page upon page, and then, oh yeah, but he's been dead this whole time. It's like he kind of, that's the only bit where I think he's kind of went, I don't know what
he's
to do here.
Shortcut with that.
We'll just say, it's just like, oh, we'll just say he was dead, because bringing him back now is just going to extend this book by another 50 pages, so we'll forget it.
He finds a porn film in Wanda, doesn't he, as well?
Yes.
Yeah, so he watches that. That's another... even watching a porn film, it's unsensual. And she definitely appears as his mother in that. There's no two ways. You can't tell me that's not meant to be a representation of his mother. And then various things happen. They discover the body of the older woman he slept with in the house in Hulligan's Wharf. He ends up meeting the sister and kind of having an affair with her behind her husband's back. A couple of detectives involve themselves in it, who turned out to be corrupt, and they get shot. It becomes a noir film, doesn't it, towards the end there?
Yeah, the last sort of 20, well, probably 15 to 20 pages, it does. It becomes a noir story after that. And with Dotty being like a crack shot and everything as well, out of nowhere. I mean, there's been threats throughout the entire book of her sort of having a homicidal nature to her, where she'll just make a comment, but you think it's just that.
Yeah,
just
she's
a comment.
Always wanting to kick the shit out.
But then she just
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll fucking kill you and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, she's just this crack shot and shoots these guys because they're threatening her. They're threatening them. Sorry, it's just surreal. Yeah.
I'm gonna say, did we really need to see him pissing that close up? No, it does. No. It does show how oblivious he is to his partner's concerns, though. He doesn't really care what she thinks or what's going on. And it also shows to me that Boring never understands the women in his life. He just everyone's having to explain things to him who aren't those women.
I think he's just forever walking around with that inner dialogue, and just completely ignoring everybody and everything around him, and is just so self-obsessed. And with getting perfection when it comes to the women, that he doesn't actually notice what he's got when he has got the woman. It's just surreal.
And as a callback, I wonder whether Whitey was the man who understood women. You know.
And yet he's there the shortest, you know, out of everybody. I mean, God, even Mrs. I always forget her name. Mrs. Thingy from Hogan's Wharf.
Mrs. Capon.
Yeah, Mrs. Capon. Even she's in it longer than what he was.
Now, this is what I wondered. Let me see what you think around this. Did David Boring kill Whitey?
I really don't know. I don't think he's gone.
Yeah, but the hat's there, isn't it? And it's not really... Dot who's done it. She's clearly too upset. Because she says, the pigs have broken in and left his hat here.
Hmm.
I really don't know if
he had it in him. I'm wondering if there was maybe somebody that we were meant to have seen that just didn't appear.
Yeah.
Like a private detective or something that had been tracing him the whole time, or an angry ex-husband or something, or for one of the women that he'd maybe tracked down, and we just never ever saw him. David's so, he's so nonplussed and he's so lazy, I don't think he would even have it in him to pick up a gun, let alone go after Whitey.
It's one of the, it's one of the books that I will think about now and will play on my mind, and I'll probably text you in a couple of weeks going, oh no, it was this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's got that element to it.
It's why it sticks with me a lot of the time. It's because even from the first time that I read it, I always think, God, that's just, I don't know who went wrong where or how he ended up getting those thoughts about so-and-so. Oh, did Wanda end up getting to that next plane of existence? Yeah. Or, you know, it's just, there's loads of little bits, loads of little threads that they just leave you on that you're not really...
There are.
You don't get any... resolve with in the slightest.
And I suppose you could ask Klaus about that, but he'd say, well, isn't that like real life, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
One of my favourite lines in it is, just because you are cold and distant doesn't mean you are smart. And I thought, that's just brilliant. It's almost like self-deprecating by Klaus. It's almost like him saying, look, I act like this. Don't mean I'm clever, I just act like this because I quite like it, or just who I am. Yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting book. It's still not my favourite book of his, but it has its appeal. As with everything he does, it's clever storytelling. It takes you to different places, and it's like you say, it's, you kind of got to keep watching. It's almost like some weird film. You just got to keep watching.
That's why I attribute to the David Lynch of it all, because it doesn't matter how many David Lynch films I watch, a lot of the time I have no clue what's happening. But I have a compelling nature to keep watching.
Yeah, I agree. I cannot
take my eyes
off
of it.
I did that with Inland Empire. I watched Inland Empire and I watched it late at night or really into the early morning. And why are there rabbits in it? Why do they keep ringing these rabbits? What is that about? You know, it's like... I find him fascinating in the same way that I find Klaus. And I know it's a lazy comparison, and people are always saying, "Oh, David Lynch," but there is a certain comparison. There's a different voice. I feel them differently, I suppose. Emotionally, I feel their style differently. But yeah, Klaus is just incredibly interesting, and he's one of those guys who has got that very niche and strange way of doing things. But his art, but there's two things. His art is very readable. It's very clear. It's very concise. A newcomer to a graphic novel who, you know, thinks, I should be into graphic novels because, you know, The Observer says it, can read his stuff. But he's very popular internationally as well, which I kind of admire. It's a hard business making your money these days in comics. But I think internationally he does very well. Yeah. You know.
I think when you make pieces like he does, as more of like an art project, it seems more of like an art project. I know he is a comics fan per se, and he does make it as a comics form strictly. It does come across more as hearkening to the Guardian crowd. It does make it more of an art piece. And I think when you do something like that, it then has a broader mass appeal to different people, because then they can take away their own conclusions from it.
Yeah. It's
not so straightforward.
His depictions of people are individual and a little bit of him. I wrote a piece today. I wrote another angry rant today online, and it was a bit about writing about stuff. Don't just like give a little bit of yourself. And there's a little bit of Klaus in everything, isn't it? There's the much touted, if you watch any YouTube interview, people always make a point of saying Klausian is now a descriptor. Yeah, and I think it's right. It has that over you know, over my head, I feel this atmosphere when I'm reading a book of his. It's got its own tenseness to it. There's no one's happy, are they? Only the idiots are happy in Klaus's books, which I always find quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this book, nobody's happy. There's very few people who are happy in this book. I can't think of any moment where anyone's like cheerful or anything. Even Whitey, who's just peculiar character, he's not happy either. You know.
No, there's nobody really. I mean, there's a little moment where Dotty and Iris are laughing, but that's about it, really. Like you say, everybody else, there's just a sort of a morbid sense of self-awareness with all of them. And there's almost like they almost all know that there's a finite amount of time for them on this world. I think that's a whole theme that goes through it, though, is finality. Yeah. Is a whole theme through the whole thing is that everybody's coming, like they all feel like the world is coming to a conclusion for them. I mean, even down to Wanda, who's found that like strange cult and everything. She's like, "Oh, I'll transcend to this next level," and you're like, "Right, you're gonna die."
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's and they all kind of know it. And even when he parts ways with that the professor.
Yeah.
Even those two kind of say, you know, may the best man win, almost like whatever one's left alive. Yeah. You know, it's strange. There's just a total theme of finality between all of them, that they're all working to this point where they're all going to eventually transcend and die, you know.
Yeah, to mention a couple of points you made there, man, is Dotty and Boring are two sides of the same predatory coin, aren't they? She preys on women who are in marriages, unhappily in marriages, and he preys on the women he thinks will make his ideal person, who you can almost frame and put on the mantelpiece, but has no realization of the reality of people's emotions. He's always looking, the grass is always greener for him, you know. The other thing is the finality is, it's got a horror. It's got is it Day of the Dead, where they land up on that island, the original version of it? Dawn of the Dead. Dawn of the Dead.
No, it's Day of the Dead, isn't it? Oh, no,
it's
not. Wait.
It's the second one where the original version of it, where they end up on an island and she's... Oh, no, it might be the third one. Is it the third one? Anyway, I can't remember. But there's a zombie movie where they end up at the end and they're on this island and they're like, oh, we're on this desert island. You think, you're dying, you're on a desert island, what are you talking about? And this is how this book ends, doesn't it? It ends on that note, but what he does is he twists your melon and he ends up on a butt. You know, he ends up swimming.
Yeah.
And he ends up spotting the butt of this woman who's been on the island and had a baby. Dottie's ex-lover.
His cousin.
And he ends up kissing her underwater. And it's he's begun the delusional cycle again, almost, you know?
Yeah. Was that not his cousin?
I can't remember, Christ.
That he had... I think it was his cousin who he had the incestuous relationship with when they were younger.
Oh, right.
And she ended up coming after everybody else had left the last time.
Right.
And so she'd been there with her kid. And, like, this is him almost... Like, he thinks it's almost coming full circle, but really it's just him starting it all over again, like you say. But, yeah, he ends on a bot. The obsession starts again, but it just starts close at home.
Yeah. And it's almost this this classic painting of the two of them kissing underwater while their hair floats away, but it's much more, it's got a different, totally different emphasis of, you know, the world is ending, he's sleeping with his cousin, he's been through all this and he's still not fucking learnt. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, those last couple of panels have definitely got more of a sinister vibe about them than all of the rest of the book. Even with gunfire and people dying and everything, those last three panels are so sinister, just because there is, I don't know, there's almost a conclusion, but you can almost feel it coming to a very morbid conclusion just with the way they're speaking and the way Klaus writes it for the last page.
Yeah, I get you. There you have it, man. We've probably made a terrible attempt at summing up the plot of that book, which people will be more confused about now. It's not a book you can understand on a first reading unless you're like really paying attention and not reading it when you get home from a 12-hour workday. Do you know what I mean? Sort of, it can be paused upon. It can be read. It's no quick read. It's it will take you a number of hours to read it. But it is interesting and it needs to be there. And he's got this voice. And I'll probably buy anything he does. I think he's one of these creators. It's an event when his book comes out, you know.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. He's somebody that, I mean, even if you weren't more taken with the story elements, I would definitely, even for an art book, I would buy this.
Right. Yeah.
If I wasn't even as much as taken with the story elements, I would get it just to marvel upon the cleanness of line and perspective and everything that he kind of presents on each panel and each page. I mean, even some of the spreads, like you were saying, the old movie posters, yeah. And some of the single pages with intros with David Boring, yeah, written in it. Like when they're going across the river and all that kind of stuff, and those three panels that you said when I'm going across the ocean with that guy, and yeah. It's worth it just
it really
for that,
is, man. Yeah,
really. There's... I mean, people have bought art books that are worth more with less in them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's that lovely distinctive line, but he does it very cleanly. He's very distinctive, but there's a cleanness. He does change. I think his patient's work again is different. His Loy Llewellyn work was slightly sort of more scratchy and scattery, and you know, there's this is when he was the cleanest line, I'm gonna say. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. You can even see that in the front cover from the face.
Can, can't you?
It's even cleaner than Ghost World. I mean, it has at the top, you know, Daniel Klaus who presented Ghost World, and you're looking at it going, it can't be like it can be the same person stylistically, but it's a totally different approach.
Yeah. I've decided it's an adjective. So next time you and I are at a convention and we're all in the bar having a drink, I'm going to use the phrase to somebody who's being boring. All right, David Boring. It's now become a phrase I'm going to adopt from now on.
No, there'll definitely be a few people.
We all know this guy. We all know this guy who's fixated on women and is like, you know, slightly absent, you know, when talking to him, but he's got this darkness about him. Yeah, it's interesting, man. Yeah, thanks for that, dude. I really enjoyed that. It's always insightful when I talk to you. Like the last one we did, same, brilliant. Yeah, good-o.
Thank you, dude. Thank you. I was going to ask you though. What would you say your favorite Klaus work actually is?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I'm going to say I don't know. I'm going to say Velvet Glove. I think. Because it moved me so much when I first saw it. It had such a profound effect on me when I read it in 8-Ball. I'd read Loy Llewellyn before that and liked it. I found it very interesting, but he had more of a sort of snarky voice. And I think when like A Velvet Glove Cast in Iron came out, I was like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, people with their crustacean eyes and everything. I began totally
entrenched in it. I remember buying it in a comic shop and like becoming like totally fixated with what this is about. This just body horror and sex and transgression. It's just strange. What about you, man? Which is your favorite?
Yeah, I'm very much with you on that one. It's either that or Mr. Wonderful,
right?
Which is completely not what Klaus would normally do, because it is very much a straightforward narrative.
Yeah.
It's an elongated kind of almost envelope-sized, slightly larger than envelope-sized book on its a horizontal book. And it's just a nice story. It's a really nice story from start to finish, and you don't get an odd vibe whilst reading that. I think because it's Klaus, you maybe do. You keep expecting it to take like a bad turn or something, but it doesn't. It's a really nice narrative throughout. But on the complete other scale, I mean, I think like A Velvet Glove is just that's something all in itself. I mean, that is just that's insanity on the page. I think that takes a disturbed and unsettling feeling to a completely new height whilst reading something. To get that awkward, you know, squidging about in your seat as you're reading it and not being able to get quite comfortable, that's quite something to be able to execute that just with a couple of pages.
Two other shout outs to Bugfucker, obviously I'm a big fan of that, and the other one is the first, I think it's the first story in Wilson, the collection, where he goes to pet a dog and the woman ignores him and walks off, or I think like, yes, I've been there, I know that moment, you know. So.
Yes, yeah, 100%. He does the voice of the dog as well. It's like, oh, she likes getting pet. And he's walking away like, Strange fucker.
I was on a Skype call the other day, or a Zoom meeting with Nobrow, and I think it's Lucy, but shout out to Lucy at Nobrow. Lucy went, "I can see Wilson on your shelf behind you," and I've got it behind me on the shelf. She spotted it. You got to love a comic fan who can spot that spot nice at a distance. You know, you always know.
Yeah.
Good shout, man. We're going to do a little bit of talking about you in a second. We're just going to pause for the advert, if you don't mind, just for a second. From our exciting sponsor, our weekday sponsor. Do you like shouting? Do you like whining? Do you feel impotent in your sad little life? Then why not join a social media platform where you can spend all day complaining and making yourself feel better, but all the while not helping anyone in any actual real way? You should join Twitter. Yes, this is from our sponsor, our new sponsor, Twitter. Thank you, Twitter, for that. Good-o. On to you, my friend. What's going on? So what's going on at Fair Spark? So you're editing some books at Fair Spark. What have you got in your intro this week?
At the moment, we've actually just launched the Little Spark.
Yep.
So we've got the preview guide, the Little Spark, that's going out to, hopefully going out to many a comic book shop that's starting to reopen, and people who are putting out orders and everything. Basically, it was meant to be a free comic book day comic, but obviously when free comic book day didn't happen and all the comic shops started to shut and we were getting worried we were going to stop seeing them, for the ones that managed to pull it back and managed to come back and are still trudging through and still opening, as a kind of thank you, in a way, we're giving them copies of this comic free, absolutely free. I mean, there's nothing to it. They don't have to buy anything from us in any way, shape or form. They just go on the Fair Spark Books website, go to the blog, and you can fill out the little form for the Little Spark preview. You can give them out to the customers, you can keep some for yourself.
Collector's edition, my friend.
Just because we're only printing so many, and then that's it, you know. But it's, you know, it's we kind of want to keep comic book shops around. And I think we're forever taken from them, and everybody's forever taken from them and not really given anything back. And then we all whine when they disappear.
No. Yeah.
And I think to show our appreciation a wee bit, I think it's only right that we give them something for free, you know, something that they don't have to then buy. I mean, most of those free comic book day things have to be bought in anyway for them to make a loss leader on. So why not we actually give them something that has no strings attached and
quality
a nice
interiors
comic.
And the covers by Andy Hanks again. And is that right? He's done a sort of a jam piece, but with Springworth in the background. It looks great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an actual, as you were saying, a collector's piece, because that's a one of a kind right there. He's done it especially for Little Heroes, but it's got Fair Spark, for the Little Spark. But it's got like a preview of a strip that you'd find in the Spark in the back as well. So you're not only getting the Fair Spark previews, you're also getting a preview for the actual Spark magazine
which
as well. So got that.
We just finalized issue 3, haven't we? So issue 3 is about to go to print. I just got it proofread by Claire Hemsworth. It's a proofreader of some renown, who's very good, and she proofread it for us the other day. So we're looking to go to print with it, I think, this week sometime. So that's good.
Shout out to Claire.
What you got planned at TCS? That comic smell. What's going on there, dude?
We're just keeping on going, man. For as long as we can, we'll just keep doing these Skype meetups as much as we can. We've got part two of our cinema talk. We're kind of talking. We talked movies back in. This is going to be good because we talked movies back in 2018, and I took ages to put it out because Mr. Mike Sedaka spoke. We were meant to be doing tops tens. And he spoke probably into top 52 or something like that. So it just kept going and going and going. So what was meant to be one episode has ended up being a two-parter because I don't think anybody could muster through 3 hours of us just talking films. So we've got the first part came out on Wednesday. The next part, we're not going to wait 2 weeks. We're just going to put it out in a week. And then it'll be 2 weeks after that. And we've already recorded it. The topic is heavy comics.
Oh, nice. Because I'm driving to Bath tomorrow. So I've got that lined up, ready to play in the car. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. Good stuff.
Oh, nice one, man. Nice one.
And what's happening? Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I know the topic's heavy comics, but we do actually, believe it or not, have a bit of a laugh as we're doing it. because I think we knew that heavy comics was going to be quite a one to kind of muster through. So we do have a bit of a laugh as we're going through it. So yeah, it's always good. I love meeting up with those guys.
Yeah, I've not met them all, but the ones I've met, yeah, and I enjoy your show very much. So yeah, it's a real friendly atmosphere. I do like it when people sort of bounce off each other. It's good. We've got Dave's coming back on this show soon, so I'm looking forward to that. Dave contacted me about the comic he wants to talk about. So very different again. Dave's chosen something very different again. I won't spoil it, but yeah, looking forward to that. So what's happening with the Lakes? So you're still doing the small press roundup on there?
Yeah, still doing that. They've taken a break, just one episode break. We all had kind of stuff going on, so they've got one break, and obviously they're busy getting ready for the upcoming like online event and everything as well. They're still in conjunction and working alongside, so they've got a lot of stuff going on. So there's one episode break. We'll be back again, I think, on the 1st. It usually goes out the 1st and the 15th every time. But I've got quite a number of views just for that one episode. So keep an eye out. I'm doing something a wee bit different just for that one. So keep an eye out.
Nice. I'll let you know about it afterwards. Good old man. So there you have it. Hopefully you got something out of that. Hopefully you now will be going off. And if you haven't read a Clowes book, what's wrong with you? Or as I saw it on a YouTube video by a woman who declared herself as the greatest Daniel Clowes book fan in the world. So there you go. You can find me normally over at neveronanything.blogspot.com, where you can read my weekly rant that I posted this week. Buy my comics, neveronanything.bigcartel. You can hear me on the Awesome Comics podcast, where I swear a lot more, and we actually have sort of a magazine show. We talk about different stuff. Follow me on Twitter, Ezohyz. Tom, where can people find you, man?
You can mainly find me across at the That Comic Smell podcast, at That Comic Smell on Twitter and Instagram. We're also on SoundCloud, YouTube, all those kind of places, iTunes, Spotify. I'm on Twitter myself at URAMYX. I've not been on it as much recently, but I am on it. And you'll be able to track down some of the Fairspark books as we spoke about, Hopper, and I've got other ones coming up in the pipeline that I'm editing and cracking on with. So nip across to fairsparkbooks.co.uk, and obviously make sure and follow at Comic Art Fest Pod to stay up to date with all the latest reviews and interviews.
They're a good bunch of people over there. I love them all. They're all good people, aren't they? Yeah.
They really are. Yeah, they really are. Really, really are. I do love being part of that wee team. Definitely. Yeah. It's a nice little bunch, definitely.
Good stuff, man. I'm going to say goodbye, and then in a minute we'll continue talking. So this is a fake. So see you later.
See you later.